Good morning. The Truth Is So Boring is here once again. My name is Scott. My pronouns are he, him. And we wish the Central Catskills a good morning. Owen, did you fail to introduce yourself with the mic
on? My mic was off. It's Owen here, he and him as usual. No change there.
And today, this morning, we wanted to bring you a very special episode. This past week, we did an interview with Colin Sutherland Wilson, our first interview ever.
Thank you so much, Colin.
He is of the Fireweed clan of the Gixxun people. His family has generations of participation in the resistance against settler colonial encroachment on indigenous land in what we in the West call Canada. Colin has been speaking out on behalf of his people and their ancient allies, the Wet'suwet'en, as they weather continued assaults on their sovereignty from settler colonial Canada and large gas extraction corporations. I contacted him on Reddit, where he has written extensively over the past few years about his experiences as the user Decolonial Man. In 2020, Colin staged a solo week-long strike of his own outside the British Columbia legislature in support of the Wet'suwet'en peoples against the Coastal GasLink pipeline. He walked out during the first week of classes on January 6th and was there from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day that week. He published a video explaining why he was doing that on the first day, and we have links to that in our notes at thetruthissoboring.org, where we will publish this episode and all of our notes on it later this week, as well as a transcription of the interview with inline citations. Thank you very much, Owen, for preparing that. That means it's a very, very cool contribution. I didn't expect that of you.
Well, I wanted the information to be available. I wanted the interview to be made available, not to just people who can hear, but also to people, not just people who can't hear, but also to people like me who are better at absorbing written information than verbal.
Unlike me, who are better at learning things from listening these days anyway.
And also, I find, honestly, it helped me to learn more by making my own study guide, basically. But I was able to follow up on quite a few things that were briefly mentioned in this interview. I've included lots and lots of inline citations of articles that describe the events we mention. If you want to get any background on anything, especially things that might sound like they're being fabricated, you can get the background on these things that actually did happen.
Yeah. So, again, big thanks to Owen and Colin for really carrying this segment. And without anything further, I think I'll go to the interview.
So, my name is Scott, and this is Owen. We do a radio show in the South Central New York, and release it as a podcast. It's all live, so this is literally the first interview we've done.
All live and all very, very amateur.
Yeah, not like a huge audience or anything, but we really appreciate your time, just wondering if you could introduce yourself and a little background into what the topic we're talking about today and how you came to know so much about it.
All right. So my name is Colin Sutherland Wilson. I'm from the Gixxun Nation of the Gisqast, the Fireweed Clan. And I come from a hereditary house known as Git Lu Shum Hetwit, which means the ones who are standing up in front. And for the past 2 years, I have basically been spending most of my time supporting my Wet'suwet'en relatives who are, one of the Fireweed clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. So they're related to us through ancient bloodlines. Even though we speak distinct languages, we have distinct territories, and various aspects of our culture are quite distinct. We are still closely related, and so I've been supporting them at the same time on our home territories here in Gixxun Lachiep. We've pretty much pushed British Columbia right off of our entire territory. So we shut down a lot of clear-cut logging that was happening there, and we're basically focusing on sustainability. So microhydro, solar, agriculture, sustainable use of forestry.
That's awesome.
Non-timber forest products. We've been, you know, it's, that's one of the things that I think people don't realize kind of a lot about the, you know, resistance movements kind of with indigenous peoples. You know, we're not trying to go back to, you know, the Stone Age, which never was the case. That's kind of, you know, I think some of the prevalent racist thinking that exists in Canadian society, but, you know, we have plans for climate labs, we have hydrologists, we have, you know, advanced scientific knowledge, kind of.
Yes.
That's just a part of a lot of many of our house membership, and, you know, there's a lot of people working hard to integrate that with our cultural values, and like, when we oppose these large destructive projects, it's not merely on the grounds of, yeah, just like, you know, these projects are bad and we say no, like, you know, we're very often proposing ourselves like numerous viable alternatives that we've been working on our entire lives, because we have inherent laws, like the Gixan law, the Ayokh, is very similar to the Wet'suwet'en law, the Anuknuweten. And those laws basically say we have to respect the right to live of the plants, the animals, and the land itself. And that they would have equal rights to us as human beings.
Yeah.
And for us to infringe upon their basic right to exist is a crime in itself that is kind of worthy of punishment. Like, that's what our oldest stories continue to tell us over and over and over again. So for us to, yeah, sit back and allow, like, you know, swaths of destruction that will only benefit folks for not even a single generation.
Yeah.
When we've been here since the last ice age, at least. It's kind of like a slap in the face just to our culture, our ethics, our history. And, yeah, that's, I mean, that's the big reason I'm involved, just as Gixan.
Yeah.
Like, we learned this stuff our whole lives. My, you know, my father was at blockades. My grandmother was at blockades. You know, my great-grandfather was literally fighting with Hudson's Bay scouts, and and like in this part of the world, the Northwest, you know, we've barely had 150 years of dealing with colonization.
Yeah.
So the prevalent attitude here is still very much like, we are sovereign people.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's really awesome. I really appreciate, you know, the opportunity to hear about the other projects that you guys have going on there, the you know, the forestry, and, you know, trying to integrate with climate and to respect nature. And I really appreciate, you know, getting the chance to hear about, you know, what you're involved in and all those projects. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what's going on with the Wet'suwet'en and, you know, what's happening there, and maybe a little bit of perspective from your end on that.
Yeah, I could definitely dive into that. So
that's kind of what kind of got my attention in all this.
Yeah,
ours, is it's kind of like a big thing right now that, I mean, certain circles you hear a lot about it, but not in others at all, you know?
Well, it's definitely a huge topic. So the Wet'suwet'en, maybe I'll just give a brief backgrounder on their society, like who the hereditary houses are, who are the players in this game. Because I think that's something that gets glazed over a lot.
Yeah, it's certainly something I wanted to focus on during this, absolutely.
Definitely. So the Wet'suwet'en, our ancient allies, they're composed of five clans. They have the Wolf Clan, which are the Gidimden, who you see pretty prevalently in the media. There's the Unist'ot'en, which are a part of the Big Frog Clan. You've got the Tsayu, the Beaver Clan, who one of the main spokespeople of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, Namox, is from the Tsayu. We have the Small Frog Clan, and we have the Fireweed Clan, which are my personal relatives down there. And basically, all five of these clans have unanimously opposed this project, the Coastal GasLink pipeline project,
mm-hmm.
which is currently being constructed across their territory after what is basically 3 years in a row of the Wet'suwet'en people being raided,
mm-hmm.
you know, with by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, with the use of, you know, heavy paramilitary gear, like we had just the last time around, assault rifles, sniper teams, helicopters, dropping people in.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, I saw some of the on the ground stuff. It was pretty scary stuff.
Oh, it was, and that, even like the little things, like they had, you know, they were running like I would call them psyops, like, you know, just playing clips from horror movies, jamming like the radio frequencies.
Oh my goodness!
Like, yeah, like people just trying to communicate.
Go ahead, Owen.
I'm just saying, like, you hear the word psyop being thrown around a lot, but that's, like, literally, that is actually what that, yeah, sorry. You don't need me to tell you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, like, you had, like, a group of matriarchs, you know, Wet'suwet'en people, in their cabin, basically being surrounded by green men, and, you know, with attack dogs, with assault rifles, with the radios being jammed with horror movie clips of, you know, little girls singing, you know, like, Ring Around the Rosie, and, like, I See You, and...
Oh, my goodness.
Like, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
And it was bad, and...
And so these tactics, just, I want to be extra clear for the you know, listeners, the tactics are being used to enforce the expansion of a pipeline, a natural gas pipeline? And this is and this is in the far west area of Canada, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I can talk about that. The RCMP, they've raided 3 years in a row based on an injunction.
Mm-hmm.
And an injunction is a legal mechanism within Canadian law to provide economic relief in the midst of a ongoing lawsuit. So it's only meant to be a temporary tool, mm-hmm. yet it's lasted 3 years long, and yeah, they continue to raid every single time the Wet'suwet'en block the roads. And the original lawsuit was filed by Coastal GasLink against Frida Hewson, Warner Nozell, those would be the folks up at Unistoten who started the initial... the initial blockade going way back, like in 2010, because they've shut down numerous pipeline projects before this point, like Enbridge, a big tar sands pipeline. They had numerous other LNG pipelines. I think in total, like TC Energy, which is the big Canadian oil company, which I think is also, you know, part of a few projects heading down into the States, they wanted to put 8 pipelines through this corridor that they're currently building with Coastal GasLink, and they were all shut down until this one, and yeah, and we've like the tactics that are being used are part of a bigger trend in BC, which is a special anti-Indigenous policing unit that's known as the CIRG, or CIRG, or CIRG, which is the Community Industry Response Group, mm-hmm. which are basically a quick response team of RCMP volunteers who get paid $100 an hour to fly all around the province and basically, you know, disrupt and attack any Indigenous-led movements.
Yeah.
So these are the folks who are, you know, beating people up in Ferry Creek, like pepper spraying them in the face, who are allowing loggers to tackle and pin down people there and, you know, say I got one and hand him over to the cops, which I think in most cases would just be straight up assault since,
yeah,
you know, I think a contractor doesn't have authority to do that. You know, the same people who...
Yeah, well, impunity for mercenaries, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, these guys were the ones who were, you know, defending the TMX pipeline, who broke Canahus Manuel's wrist, who, you know, were up on Wet'suwet'en year after year with the heavy tactical gear. And a lot of them are derived from the, I guess, the RCMP E Division, which is a pretty big division that covers most of BC, but they're the specialized ERTs, the Emergency Response Team, which are basically like a heavily outfitted and geared unit meant to take on dangerous threats, you know, like counterterrorism, like, you know, taking on folks who are firing guns back at them.
Mm-hmm.
And so meanwhile,
oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, I was just gonna say, and meanwhile, like the people that they're mobilizing against have been entirely peaceful, like never once presenting any type of threat to warrant, like the degree of force they bring to our territories.
No, no. I mean, you're just, you know, standing there preventing the project from continuing. From what I've seen, is that right?
Yeah,
I saw some pretty awesome tactic, in my opinion, that was where they took the excavating machine and used it to like take out a section of the road and just like demolish it, and so that the trucks couldn't go by. I thought that was pretty awesome. I didn't mean to kind of seem like I wasn't interested in the internal politics of, like, you were talking about, like, the clans and the nations and all that. I didn't mean to, like, redirect away from that. I wanted to, like, just get a little chance to get some background in there. So if you want to go back into that topic a little more, then I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think I'll talk about, you know, just, yeah, the basis of what's happening. Because, you know, the Gik'san and Wet'suwet'en were intricately linked through our histories, through our alliance. We've had a mutual defense pact to protect our territories for millennia. And more recently, like, leading up to this conflict of Coastal GasLink, we took the crown to court in our famous series of court cases known as Delgamuukw versus British Columbia, or Delgamuukw versus the Queen. And in these court cases, our hereditary houses represented themselves. We had plaintiffs representing the 60-plus houses of the Gik'san alongside the 13 houses of the Wet'suwet'en, who over the course of the years from 1987 until 1991 delivered about 365 days worth of testimony outlining our culture, our boundaries, our laws, and this resulted in a verdict where Aboriginal title, as they call it, because within Canadian law they, you know, many times they'll always dodge the fact that we do retain title to our land, like legally, even under Canadian law. So they'll, you know, come up with terms when we beat them in the courts, like Aboriginal title, which,
oh,
yeah,
you know, it's some kind of lesser form of title.
Oh, well, it's the ones we made that we didn't mean to keep.
yeah, exactly. And so, you know, we, through the BC Court of Appeals, following that 91 decision, which, like, the judge basically said, oh, like, you guys are just savages, you've had
neither the
written word, and lived in a state of war of all against all. And that was Alan McEachern, and hugely controversial at the time.
Yeah.
He dismissed all the evidence of our expert witnesses, including you know, like very renowned anthropologists and different academics. And so that was appealed, thankfully. And as a result of that appeal in 93, the courts essentially ruled that, you know, our title, like the underlying basic title that predates and pre-exists Canada, had never been extinguished by British Columbia, and that BC had no authority to do so or power to do so. And in 97, this was further clarified by referring to an old British law, which is the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which basically outlined that without a due process or a transfer of land to the Crown itself, that land could not be obtained otherwise. And this is one of the reasons for the American Revolution. This was, a pretty monumental law at the time, following a war with Chief Pontiac in the East, where numerous British forts were burned down. And basically, this led to all the treaties across eastern Canada. And so within Canadian law, like enshrined in the Constitution, it basically says that land cannot be transferred without a due process, without a treaty, without some form of agreement. And in the case of Wet'suwet'en and Gik'san land, that agreement has never been achieved.
Mm-hmm.
The underlying position of the Gik'san and Wet'suwet'en has always been like, we will never surrender one inch of our territory.
So when you see the map of Canada online and Canada goes right up to Alaska, that's probably not what it should be, is what you're maybe suggesting there?
Yeah. It's, specifically all of British Columbia, or most of British Columbia, aside from a few nations that did sign treaties, is unceded land.
Wow.
And that was one of the big things that came up in the court case. Like, this was the issue that was being fought for over 10 years in the courts during Delgamuukw. And by the end of it, it was established that it's the Gik'san and Wet'suwet'en peoples, through our traditional governance structures, who hold the underlying title to the territories.
That's something I kind of want to emphasize there. The court case you're saying said that the hereditary houses have those deeds, correct?
Exactly.
That's one of the things that like has made me very hesitant to talk about this specifically, is like getting into it. There's a lot of sources that you see kind of legitimizing the Coastal GasLink project through this elected. I don't know the words for it, but they have like some sort of agreement with some sort of. I should have looked up the words for this.
Oh, the band councils.
The councils, yeah. And could you talk a little bit about, you know, what legitimizes those and or what legitimizes the hereditary houses and as it relates to this a little bit?
Yeah.
Because that's kind of something that I really wanted to pin down and try to understand, because as soon as you start digging into this, it starts to get really murky at that point, you know?
It's really easy for people to spin doctor this.
Oh, yeah. No, I've definitely heard it. It's... Yeah, it's the whole reason I just started jotting down my thoughts on Reddit.
Back.
So the band councils are a part of the Indian Act. So starting in 1876, we had the Indian Act introduced in Canada. And that basically led to the framework of reserves of... bringing our people off of our wider territories, which we've traditionally occupied, and confining us to reserves. You know, we had pass systems that, didn't allow us to leave for a long time. We had, an amendment in 1880 to the Indian Act, which disallowed us from gathering, from participating within our governance. All of the heavy-handed repression, that didn't end until 1950. This era, like, our hereditary governments basically were forced to go underground. Like, I personally have a one of my grandfathers on my father clan side, Edward Sexsmith, he was actually pulled out of a feastal, which is our traditional governance house, you know, by the RCMP, and he died of pneumonia in a RCMP prison as an elder and the chief of our nation, you know, during this whole era.
That's terrible.
So our people call it kind of the Prohibition era, where, you know, we were losing a lot of life to, you know, one, like the smallpox and, you know, the various diseases that were coming through, but also, you know, our people being arrested and criminalized just for trying to follow through with our culture. And at the same time, you know, our kids were being stolen and put into residential schools. So that was, I would call it the Dark Ages kind of here. It's not a good time. And so,
I'd agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes the Dark Ages sound nice.
Right?
So around this time, like, the Indian Act ban councils were imposed as a control mechanism. Because not once, like, throughout that history has Canada ever recognized our traditional governance. Like, to them, we were pretty much always backwards, you know, savages who, you know, didn't fall in line with the Western politic and democracy. You know, at the same time, like,
democracy as they define it.
As they define it, exactly, because we have so many democratic values, mm-hmm. you know, baked into our system that, you know, may not be recognizable at a glance because of some of the English that's used to translate, you know, an entirely different language and political system, kind of for Western consumption. But yeah, basically, like, the inherent racism within the system, I'll just say that, like, really, it was geared against our traditional governance. And that's the case in Kiksan and Wet'suwet'en territory. Like, and so the band councils were put on the reserve. And just one thing, important thing about the band councils is that they were meant to phase out our people, like, that we would be assimilated within generations into the Canadian mainstream, that the Indian problem would no longer exist, our title claims would no longer exist, and we would simply be Canadian citizens, and all the land would be secured as crown land.
Mm-hmm. Through a sort of
ready for settlement and further development.
So their goal was sort of an explicit cultural imperialism, where they, you know, sequester off those who don't conform, and then, like, make their you know, whoever's willing to conform into their culture. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would think so. It's you know, cultural imperialism. Straight up genocide,
yeah.
Like, which is the erasure of a distinct social group or a distinct identity, and yeah, that came through the forms of just straight murder, burning down of homes, you know, enabling of vigilante violence throughout the Northwest, direct RCMP state repression, the removal of children, the destruction of culture and language, and just numerous other factors. It was, yeah, like I said, the Dark Ages. But we did persist. Like, our hereditary houses, our cultural people, our language, like, it all persisted underground. But, so the band councils... Oh, yeah, sorry.
No, I was just saying, like, I was just expressing, like, that I'm glad that you've managed to hang on, because I, you know, I find a lot of things about, every time I learn about a new form of culture, it's just like, it blows my mind about the diversity of the way that we can organize ourselves, and how rigid and strict the US, Canada, Western Europe, whatever, sees everyone should be some certain way. And I always appreciate it whenever a culture that isn't that is preserved, because it's, I like to learn about this diversity and whatnot, you know?
Oh, definitely. It's, I mean, that's a whole other topic.
Of course, yeah, sorry.
No, that's fair. Like, I'll just maybe say, like, a couple words about it. We, you know, many of the cultures of the Northwest were very ancient peoples. Like, we come from continuous civilizations that go back millennia. Like, our oral histories describe glaciation periods. They describe entire eras of climate upheavals. They describe ancient migrations and entire species that don't even exist in this world right now.
Wow.
And, you know, I think that's pretty rare, like, when it comes to most human civilizations that are kind of still, you know, on Earth. And
yeah, it's valuable knowledge, you know?
Yeah, it's an absolute wealth of knowledge, and just the details and the description of the human experience. And, you know, that's kind of a lot of the stuff we're really trying to protect. Because it's pretty rare at this point, especially with this kind of turbulent era of humanity that we've all universally gone through in the past 500 years or so.
Yeah. Well, wow. I want to thank you so much for how much information that you've, you know, managed to convey in such a short period of time. Like I said, you've already given us so much, but I do want to, like, give you the chance to just, you know, if there's anything that you feel like we haven't talked about that you wanted to talk about, you know, have a chance to do that. And also, I was hoping there were some resources that we could point to anyone who happens to listen to this to, maybe link to on our website and whatnot.
Yeah, all right. So I guess the one thing I really want to emphasize is that, yeah, legally, like, it is Wet'suwet'en land. The land of the Wet'suwet'en hereditary houses. Like, there's no ifs or buts about it. It's Supreme Court case law, the highest law.
Yeah, I mean, even set aside, you know, what's right and what should be, their courts say it's yours, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is Canadian law, not, you know, this is the Canadian court saying they shouldn't be doing this, and yet they are.
Yeah.
Not to say that the Canadian court is more legitimate than, like,
well, no, but...
like, you going to follow your own rules or what? Well, we could have a whole conversation about that, but...
No, I hear you there. That's often something that comes up, too. Because I'm not trying to legitimize the Canadian courts. Like, the baseline within our laws is... yeah, like, this is, like, 100% our land. It's always been. We're not asking for anything more than, you know, what we've taken care of for thousands of years already. Like, we're not expansionists or anything like that. But yeah, like, we took them to their own courts, like, fundamentally racist courts,
and beat them
in logic, like,
yeah.
Beat them with the truth, and, you know, they did not want to acknowledge our title. Like, they even made up numerous terms within the court case or following it. You know, okay, like, we recognize you have the title to the land, so, you know, we're going to outline what constitutes a justifiable infringement of that title. And so they just kind of made up rules on, you know, like, what allows them to completely undermine and, yeah, just violate our title. And, you know, that's kind of the game within the Canadian courts. So I don't, you know, I'll never fully stand behind, like, you know, that legal system, because I know, like, they fundamentally cannot undermine the sovereignty of the nation state, which delegates them power, which is kind of the case here when you're, you know, we have court cases starting to deal with the sovereignty of, you know, Indigenous nations that are, whose territories are, you know, being assumed by Canada. So that's, yeah, that's fundamentally the root of it. And you know, when it comes to these band councils, we have, like, private industries funneling millions of dollars into non-disclosed agreements to get the permission of a select few to, like, directly undermine the title claims of the hereditary chiefs while getting payouts and, it's, you know, I think regardless of where you come from, like, it's kind of the same old story of, you know, greed undermining the, you know, the rights of the collective. And so that's fundamentally what we're dealing with here. And, you know, we're making big headway along those lines because, you know, regardless of, you know, where you stand on particular projects, like a lot of people are just appalled by the RCMP violence. You know,
yeah, but
I know,
from what you've been saying, that sounds like it's almost status quo, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's, I mean, that's, yeah, it's always been the case. Thankfully, though, like, just within the mainstream Canadian public, like, we are noticing a lot more people who are actually getting educated on these matters, who are looking into Indigenous law, like the court precedents, Delgamuukw, you know, the history, what's been happening up here. And, you know, it's starting to get, you know, the conversation's getting deeper than just, you know, anti-pipeline protesters, you know, cause trouble for a project. Like, no, people are starting to realize, like, hey, like, an ancient Indigenous government, like, older than the pyramids of Egypt, like, older than Stonehenge, is, you know, opposing the infringement of their territorial boundaries by a project which never received consent, despite British Columbia and Canada signing an act into effect, like UNDRIP, which specifies that they do require free, prior, informed consent. And, you know, and then also, like, there's all of our numerous rights that we fought in the highest courts of the land, and this and that, like, there's people starting to figure out what's going on, starting to figure out just the blatant colonization that's taking place. And like, our people, you know, that's great. Like, we fought alone for such a long time. And, you know, we now have relationships all throughout the world. There were solidarity actions happening in Africa and Japan, like, you know, during the second raid. Like, it's, so we're never going to give up our position. That's tantamount to giving up on our culture, which, you know, is not an option, like for us. That's, so, yeah, that's hard to see. And if you want,
Canadians wish they would.
I'll just quickly share some resources. Like if you want to really do the deep dive on the history and the updates of what's happening, like, look up Yinta Access, like, on Instagram, Facebook, Wet'suwet'en Checkpoint. From the Gixan side, like, we have Gitlu from Het'wit Media, which is a mouthful. But, like, I'm sure if you just look up Wet'suwet'en Checkpoint or Yinta Access, you could just follow those branches. And
yep.
Yeah, yep. There's tons of interviews with chiefs, elders,
and we'll be,
like,
sure to,
legal,
we'll be sure
explainers.
To, we'll be sure to make links to that in the notes whenever we post this online as well, for sure. Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. This has been awesome, honestly. I exceeded my expectations. Thank you very much, Colin.
Yeah, thank you.
No worries.
Yeah, thank you.
He was such a pleasant person to interview. That went swimmingly, I think. I felt really good about it.
He was very understanding. I felt a little awkward that throughout that.
Yeah, I mean...
listening back to it, especially.
Yeah, I felt like I interrupted him a couple times, and I really didn't want to, but also, he seemed to appreciate what I was saying, so that was validating, I suppose. But we had a lot of technical difficulties, too, so I just want to, like, emphasize, like, this person was extremely patient with us, and we very much appreciated his time.
Yeah, and you said there was something that you felt got underemphasized as you were, you know, looking into this further, and you wanted to maybe summarize things and try to reemphasize a certain point?
Sure, yeah. I was trying to explain this to my grandma in a short period of time the other day, and I kind of nailed something down in my head that I felt like I didn't quite put together until I spent more time with the material, which is that the Indian Act in Canada, one of the ways that... Okay, I'm going to back up. So there are two governing structures that you will see mentioned in media about this, the hereditary houses, which go back millennia.
And the band councils.
And the band councils, which were established by the Indian Acts.
Mm-hmm.
The band councils were established by the Indian Acts simultaneously with forced enfranchisement laws, which stated such things as if you married into a Canadian family, then you would lose your status as a Native American indigenous person. And also it outlined a lot of like blood quanta type rules and stuff about like counts as officially Native American and who doesn't. And then it uses those rules to keep whoever they basically don't want in the band council out of the band council. And then the band council has all of the legal power in Canadian law in those areas. Or it had until, you know, they took the crown to court as we described.
And then established that the land was unceded from the hereditary clans. And so what you're saying is that the band councils were, upheld as legitimate for a while, and then they were taken to court and it was reestablished that the hereditary, houses had the, it was their land.
Yeah.
Okay.
And until then, like, it basically the Canadian legitimization of the band council, like the Canadian law only recognized the band councils, which had a very limited pool of eligibility,
mm-hmm.
you know, so basically, and hereditary houses also, like the chiefs that system is a lot more democratic than the band council system. Like, they're both elected, but generally speaking, the band councils aren't nearly as accountable to the community mm-hmm. as your chief.
Mm.
And that's another way, like combined with the compulsory enfranchisement and
in summary it's up to the hereditary houses whether or not a pipeline gets run through their land and their water, and they say no, but the RCMP and the band council in some cases and all of that says yes, and so now we have conflict.
Yeah. Very complicated and very worth understanding because, again, mm-hmm. like as we said, very easy to spin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about all the time we have for that subject, unfortunately. It deserves a lot more. I will, like I said, we'll post a ton of resources if you want to look up the details on this, get more information. You can also go to yintaaccess.com. That's yintaaccess.com for more information. You can also go to, you can search the Wet'suwet'en checkpoint. And I'm not going to botch this name. I'm just going to post the link instead. it's Colin's house name.
Yeah.
And it is not something
mouthful,
that,
as they
it is, yes, as it, is, it is a mouthful, and I do not wish to disrespect it by saying it wrong. So we'll include the link there, and I highly recommend you look into it because there's a lot of resources. So. I also wanted to say rest in peace. Delgamuukw himself, the defendant in the Delgamuukw trial versus British Columbia and the Crown, which we discussed, passed away this January 2nd, and I just wanted to acknowledge their passing.
As we continue with our program today, I have another topic I wanted to talk about. As another example of Western imperialism, and with Russian and Ukrainian and U.S. tensions back in the news again for the first time since we began the program,
mm-hmm.
I thought a few minutes... I thought the few minutes left in the hour could be spent providing some background into this situation, which I think is not very well known. I'm not an expert in this, but I think this is context which should not be left out of the conversation. More background can be found on several episodes of Congressional Dish, primarily episode 244. And I've heard this from other sources too. I just didn't want to get into linking too much on this because it's pretty straightforward once you start digging into the details. They don't really hide this very well.
I think Jen did a really good job of like unpacking it too.
Mm-hmm.
So I highly recommend her source.
Yeah, that is about a 2-hour session though, as opposed to the 5 minutes that we have or so dedicated to this. The International Monetary Fund. I just wanted to go over a list of players in this. This is being presented as there's a list of people and stuff that are involved in this, and then there are three clips which I want to play, which are relevant in my opinion. So just some background information. The players involved in this are the International Monetary Fund, which is an international financial institution headquartered in Washington, D.C., consisting of 190 countries. I didn't know there were that many. I thought there was like 180 some. So that's probably almost all of them. Its mission is, quote, working to foster global monetary cooperation, secure financial stability, facilitate international trade, promote high employment and sustainable economic growth, and reduce poverty around the world. This work is done by loaning cash from wealthy countries to ones which are struggling. These loans come with strings attached, policies which must be changed or added as a condition of accepting the loan. This comes from a sentiment that seems on its face to be less than sinister. After all, there must be a reason these countries are in financial trouble, so it would be irresponsible to loan them money without addressing these reasons, lest the debtor not be able to repay the debt. In practice, the reason many of these countries which have been loaned money by the IMF are in financial trouble is due to exploitation, or worse, sanctions. Because many, not all, of these situations are caused by external forces, this results in the IMF functioning more as a way for the wealthy, exploitative capitalist oligarchies to change laws and rule over countries which don't align with the neoliberal world order. If this sounds nuts, please spend some time listening to Congressional Dish. It took me lots of evidence to start saying things like that.
And it's really complicated. There's a lot involved. So, you know, beware of anyone who tries to oversimplify it.
The next player is Viktor Yanukovych, who was the fairly elected president of Ukraine from 2010 until he was ousted in the early 2014 Revolution of Dignity. The Revolution of Dignity was a protest movement and eventual violent ousting of the president after he announced plans to accept a loan from Russia instead of one from the IMF.
Oh, the horror. Next up is Victoria Nuland, our current Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. From 2013 until 2017, she was the Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. And in the audio clip we're about to play, she's speaking with Jeffrey Piat, or Piat.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk?
Yats.
Who Nuland apparently affectionately calls Yats, was the Prime Minister of Ukraine from 2014 to 2016. And I want to note that, confusingly, Ukraine has both a president and a prime minister.
Mm.
So that's interesting.
And was Yats the far right or someone else?
That's somebody else.
Okay.
Petro Poroshenko is not mentioned directly in these clips, but it's relevant to know that he is the president of Ukraine since 2014, since the elections that followed the ousting of Yanukovych, and is a far-right Ukrainian nationalist who outlawed communist imagery in 2015 on a policy of decommunization. His presidency was distilled into a three-word slogan: military, language, faith.
Fascism.
Another relevant player in this who wasn't mentioned is John Kerry, who was seen taking part in rallies in support of the Revolution of Dignity. Further, Vitaly Klitschko, who Nuland and Piat call Klitsch, is the mayor of Kyiv and the head of Kyiv city-state administration. And finally, Ole Tanibok is the leader of the far-right ultranationalist Svoboda political party in Ukraine. So, with all of that in mind, I hope you followed that, because maybe a bit much. I would like to play this leaked phone conversation from Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt, which was released, which was leaked online on February 4th, 2014.
What do you think?
I think we're in play. The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister. And you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yachts. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Good. So I don't think Cleach should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you think, what in terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking in terms of sort of the process moving ahead, we want to keep the moderate Democrats together. The problem is going to be Tanibok and his guys. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of what Yanukovych is calculating on all of this.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tanibok on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's, you know? I think that's right. Okay, good.
The next clips I have for you are from a conference at the Council on Foreign Relations, which you can find on YouTube under the title Joe Biden on Defending Democracy. These two clips aren't like right next to each other in the
source.
Yeah, but they are.
We pulled the relevant bits.
Some particular. No, there's a lot of relevant bits in this.
Okay,
and these are just the really juicy ones.
In the piece, the two of you say that there's no truth that the United States, unlike what Putin seems to believe or say, that the U.S. is seeking regime change in Russia. So the question I have is, should we be? And if not, if we shouldn't be seeking regime change, what should we be seeking in the way of political change inside Russia? What's an appropriate agenda for the United States vis-a-vis Russia internally?
All right, and one more. This is Joe Biden at the same conference, I guess.
I mean, I'll give you one concrete example. I was, but it just happened to be that was the assignment I got. I got all the good ones. So I got Ukraine. And I remember going over convincing our team, or others, to convincing us that we should be providing for loan guarantees. And I went over, I guess, the 12th, 13th time to Kyiv, and I was supposed to announce that there was another $1 billion loan guarantee. And I had gotten a commitment from Poroshenko and from Yatsenyuk that they would take action against the state prosecutor, and they didn't. So they said they were walking out to press conference. We're not going to give you the $1 billion. They said, you have no authority. You're not the president. The president said. I said, call him. I said, I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion. I said, you're not getting $1 billion. I'm going to be leaving here. And I think it was, 6 hours? I looked, I said, I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. Well, son of a bitch. Got fired. And they put in place someone who was solid at the time.
So that is just a few quick examples of United States high-ranking officials basically acting like it's their choice who sits in office in Kyiv. And that seems like some very relevant context considering the conflict and aggression and I want to say like borderline proxy war going on since 2014 that is, you know, once again bubbling to the surface. And I think Biden's personal involvement in that is pretty relevant also.
For real, though, what kind of moron starts a land war with Russia in the middle of winter?
All right. Thanks for the chaser, Owen. I think that wraps up today's episode of The Truth Is So Boring. Thanks again.
Not even going
to
give us the weather?
No. Thanks again to Colin Sutherland Wilson for his content on the Wet'suwet'en and the Gik'san defending their land in what we in the West call Canada. And finally, you can find our episode later today at The Truth Is So Boring with a link to the annotated transcript. And you can catch us in 2 weeks here on WIOX at 9 a.m. on Thursday morning.
And also tomorrow, every Friday, from 2 to 4 p.m., we do Cat's Chill. We play a lot of cool music. Looking forward to having fun tomorrow. Also, there's going to we are in the midst of a winter weather advisory. Watch out for sleet and ice. It's been getting warm, melting the snow, and then getting cold again, melting or freezing it back into ice. So be careful in the evenings and early mornings, especially driving and walking around.
And to finish off the show, here is Bloodywood with their new song Aj from their album, which is coming out in a couple weeks.
Bloodywood is
Indian folk metal is what they call themselves.
Yeah, and they're great. We just recently discovered them, and we've really been getting into their stuff, so we wanted to share it with you. Hope you're enjoying this as much as we are. This has been The Truth Is So Boring here at WIOX Community Radio 91.3 FM.
Never seen them all. I was trapped and put it all together as I swore down, smashed and fade in the shredder.
you know, fuck the EU.